You're listening to Opera Box Score.
Let's get ready to rumble!
Wherever you are, however you're listening, it's America's Talk Radio Show about opera. It's Opera Box Score. I'm George Cedarquist, joined by Ashley Hardgrave. All right, this week, Harry Bickett, music director of Santa Fe Opera, takes a free throw on being pigeonholed as an early music specialist. Sorry, Oliver. This summer, Maestro Bickett conducts Gian Giovanni, and we ask him to weigh in on what's his favorite act of a Mozart opera. Then, it's all very well for us to bust a bracket finding the best School of Music voice program, but what are those departments actually teaching, and how does it relate to what a modern freelance performer actually needs to know?
And then it's a bonus free throw from tenor Jonathan Tettelman, making a double debut at the Met. First up is La Rondine this Saturday, which will be broadcast in HD.
Plus, in the two-minute drill, major awards scandal, or not, at the NY Phil, budget cuts in Paris, and all hail the tempo police. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast, Spotify, you click and follow, Apple Podcasts, hit that plus sign, send us a voice memo, email us your hot takes, mailbag@operaboxscore.com. You can even just record your thoughts. You got something to say. That's the tab on the website, operaboxscore.com. We're going to ask you to do that later in the show. And remember, however you contribute, going to get the OBS beer coaster, the OBS lapel pin, and the number one OBS fan foam finger, just for sharing your hot take. Now, Ashley, this is like an actual sports talk radio show. It's two people who know a lot about sports. It's Cedarquist and Hardgrave.
I mean, if this isn't a dynamic duo, listeners, I don't know what is. And what is also dynamic right now is the WNBA draft. It started just before we started recording. Clearly, you will hear many more things about this over the coming days. But in an unsurprising move, the Indiana Fever selected Iowa's Caitlin Clark as the number one WNBA draft pick. Shout out to our hometown team, the Chicago Sky, for picking up Cardozo from South Carolina. That is going to be awesome. And right now we are on pick 11. I can't tell who's on the clock, but yeah, we're rocking and rolling, going right through. By the way, did you see Caitlin Clark on Saturday Night Live this weekend?
I did not, but tell me.
It was awesome. So Michael Che is one of the two anchors of Weekend Update, and he often makes jokes about women's sports. They're jokes. They're supposed to be funny. And all of a sudden, he makes a joke about women's sports in the WNBA draft. And then here to comment on it is Caitlin Clark, and it shows up. And sometimes they'll do like impersonations of people. Mm-hmm. So I kind of thought that's what it was going to be. No, it was the real Caitlin Clark. And she came on and said, "Yeah, you seem to make a lot of jokes about women's sports." And he was like, "Oh, no, I don't think so." And Colin Jost's co-anchor was like, "Actually, you do. I've put together a supercut." And so it shows clip after clip after clip of him making jokes about women's sports. They cut to Caitlin Clark, and she's like, "You know, I've written a couple of jokes of my own that I would like you to read." And so they were these really sort of like mildly embarrassing jokes to Michael Jost that were hilarious. But it was this really great, good-natured, just a cute little clip in the SNL Weekend Update. And then she closes with, you know, expressing gratitude for all of the players that came before her, before this incredible moment. It was just an awesome moment in women's sports. It seems like we're having a lot of those lately.
I just loved Caitlin Clark's quote. So after Iowa lost the women's NCAA national championship, one of the things she said 100% honestly was, "You know what? It's been a great ride. I will still be able to go to sleep every night never having won a national championship. It's okay."
A lot of people were like, "Oh, well, she needs to have it." I'm like, "No, she's fine. She has scoring records for days. She gonna be all right."
I'm sad right now because we are approaching the end of hockey season. So the Frozen Four is over in the NCAAs. The Chicago Wolves are out of the American Hockey League playoffs. The Red Wings are trending out of the NHL playoffs. I don't even have time to play rat hockey anymore because I'm too busy teaching and directing. It's just like, you know, when you sort of just all you can see is baseball season looming ahead of you and 182 games of nothingness.
Yes, I actually do. This is that part of the year where I just get kind of bored with sports. I don't really enjoy, I mean, I I am more interested in baseball, I'll put it this way, when the stakes are a bit higher, when we're through part of the 5,482 games that are part of a regular Major League Baseball season, even though they've cut them down with things like the pitch clock. So I, yeah, this is kind of that like purgatory time when there's just not that much that I'm super into happening. But, you know, the NBA playoffs are going to be around the corner and those will garner a little bit of my interest.
Wait till August when you're really miserable. Let's talk some opera. Free throw. They say that air travel this summer is going to be very busy and expensive. So if you're planning on going to Santa Fe, you should decide which operas you want to see. Book your tickets now. You'll definitely want to catch Rosenkavalier with friend of this show, Rachel Willis Sorensen and Ying Fang, and Don Giovanni with FOS's Ryan Speedo Green as the Don, and Solomon Howard, whoa, as the Commendatore. That's conducted by one of the leading conductors for 18th century music, Harry Bickett. Oliver sat down with Maestro Bickett to ask him about being categorized as an early music specialist.
You're conducting Don Giovanni at Santa Fe this summer. And last summer, my colleagues and I had this sort of debate as to what is the single best act of a Mozart opera. And the finalists were Don Giovanni 1, Così fan tutte 1, and Magic Flute, and Marriage of Figaro 2. I was backing Don Giovanni 1 just because of how fast it goes and how much invention there is and how, every character is so clearly defined. And it's really breathless. I'm not a big fan of Don Giovanni Act 2. I feel like it loses its momentum. And I'm also not a fan of that aria metà di voi. Would you like to back an act or defend Don Giovanni Act 2?
No. I think you make a really good point because, I mean, you know, we all talk about these masterpieces, but it doesn't mean that every single aria is perfection, or every single join, or every ensemble. I mean, I feel sometimes with Handel that, you know, like in Alcina, the second act of Alcina is just too much because he just puts one genius aria after the next, and you kind of want a mediocre aria just to spread it out a little bit. I mean, I think that the second act of Così is really weak. The finale. I don't mean. Oh no, my God! The music in the second act is incredible, but the finale itself is not as perfectly put together.
Yeah, I feel like they didn't know how to get to the end. It's like, oh well, here it's gonna.
he goes around in circles, and also not helped by the libretto at that point. No. I mean, the most profound bits of. I mean, because he is one of my most favorite pieces ever. So again, I think Act Two finale of Figaro is, you know, on paper, as perfect as you can get. I think it's extraordinary. It's absolutely extraordinary. And, you know, I've done runs of like 17, 20 performances of that piece for Glyndebourne, and you would think that you'd get bored by it or somehow, you know, oh my God, what are we going to do with that tonight? And each time it's just like, no, it's total genius. There's just no way around it. So I don't know. I mean, it's like, what's your favorite movie or your favorite dish or
it kind of varies. Can you defend metà di voi, or can you tell me what is that doing in that act? Why is it there?
No, not especially. I think there are things that as a 21st century audience that we don't get in the way that the ears of an 18th century audience would have got, and there's no real equivalent. There's no clever way of making it work, and I think, you know, directors sometimes struggle with that because instead of letting the music just be and also accept that things are sort of happening in real time. That's one of the big things in 18th century opera, is that, you know, the pace. I mean, you talk about it being fast paced, and it's true. It was the beginning of, you know, Mozart realizing that actually the lengths of a piece like Mitridate were not going to survive much longer. Mozart, of course, being in Vienna, one forgets that there were other composers there in the court. I mean, Salieri, for one, but also Martini Soler, who was the writer of Una Cosa Rara, which is the piece that's played in Don Giovanni, and Giovanni makes a rude comment about it. It was sort of an in joke, but Una Cosa Rara was hands down the most popular show in Vienna, way more popular than anything Mozart ever wrote. But the music was not of such a high quality, but Martini Soler knew how to write a good tune and not hang around too long. You know, he knew how to do it, please the audiences, move on. And that's why commercially he was a much more successful composer in many ways than Mozart in his day. I mean, Mozart was sort of the Stephen Sondheim to Martini Soler's Andrew Lloyd Webber. And, you know, I'm not being rude about Andrew Lloyd Webber, but, you know, again, the ability to write a really, really good, just a shade, how to write a really, really good tune that wasn't so clever that you'd kind of alienate people. Mm-hmm. And of course, Mozart tried to do it with Magic Flute. But Mozart couldn't help himself. He can only write devastatingly profound music. I mean, he even when he tried to write something light, you look at the wind serenades, the music that he was writing to be played outdoors while people talked and drank and smoked, are some of the most beautiful things he ever wrote. You know, he couldn't just write ordinary music. He didn't have it in him.
Well, just to close that topic, I would say that Venite Inginocchiatevi in Act Two of Mozart is the piece of, what is this doing in here? But for whatever reason, I can tolerate that aria. Like, I feel like it's tuneful enough. It's like, yeah, I mean, you know.
But also, it's actually, unusually for Mozart, it's a functional aria. I mean, it's actually...
Yeah, it's advancing the plot, you know, yeah.
Because usually...
Yeah.
Arias normally just stand still and someone emotes. And there, I would agree with you. But that one actually... weirdly, actually is sort of like a recitative in terms of its function. Yeah. So I think we can forgive him that.
Finally, in our interview for WFMT, you sort of alluded to the idea that you don't appreciate being categorized as a early music specialist. And I'll accept that. I think of it as a compliment. I think of my early music colleagues as some of the most... comprehensive musicians because they are thinking about rhetoric and they're thinking about tone quality and they're thinking about technique and they're thinking about improvisation, which are maybe three things on that list that, people who specialize in another type of music don't even ever think about. But what is it with you? I feel like you are actually the future of classical music, somebody who has clearly all of this knowledge about the style, but want to do everything. But is that fair?
Well, yeah, and I would just to defend myself slightly. I mean, what I was trying to say was that I don't see why the things that you've mentioned, which is completely all the things I'm keen about, should be only present within early music. I mean, I think the idea of rhetoric and of improvisation, why is that the exclusive world of early music? I mean, I think in early music, it's true, you have to work very hard at it because what you get on the page is just a sketch. But I think any, you know, good thinking musician, should have that in their arsenal. I mean, whether you're doing Mahler or Stravinsky, I mean, admittedly, a lot of it's more prescribed in that kind of music. And I would say that, you know, I'm sounding like a bit of an old man now, which I probably am, but, you know, after, when I look back 30 years, even 40 years, when I used to go to modern orchestras and do this repertoire, I mean, it's unrecognizable now. It's absolutely unrecognizable now. I mean, these orchestras, these younger players, they just, you know, they come in and they go, yeah, damn right, we're not going to play Mozart the same way that we play Mahler. But 25 years ago, that you could have, people would say, no, this is our sound. This is the way we play. So I think, you know, that huge strides have been made. And I think that's, you know, I think that's completely wonderful. But no, I mean, I'm with you. I think the categorization is just something that happens to you rather than something you say, this is what I am. I mean, you know, I did Pelias last year, which is a piece I completely adore so much. And I worked on it many years ago with Boulez and when I was in England at ENO and you know, I don't want to say that I'm a French music specialist either. I mean, I just think a good musician, I worked for years with Charles Mackeras, who's somebody who I, you know, used to do Purcell, and he also used to do Strauss wonderfully, you know, and I think he was just a fantastic all-round musician and was interested, always curious about music and, you know, and not just the research about the composer and the intentions, but just, you know, performance conventions. I think the thing that early music has really helped me understand is how to view music through a certain kind of prism. So, you know, when I did Fidelio at Santa Fe in 2014, I was fascinated that this piece had been written so close to Mozart's lifetime. I mean, Mozart was barely, you know, cold in his grave, and here was Fidelio being written. And when you view Fidelio through the prism of Mozart, as opposed to the prism of, I don't know, Mahler, I mean, the person who championed it, that piece so much, you get a completely different view, because you just realize how completely insane that piece was to have been written within the context of Vienna and Mozart. It was just so revolutionary. And now it doesn't sort of feel that way, but how do we recapture that? How do we get that sense of what a complete landmark, flawed landmark, but landmark, a piece like that was? And I think as soon as you start doing that, again, Carmen, if you look at Carmen through the prism of Offenbach, who, I mean, Offenbach was the king of the opera comique. And, you know, families used to take their kids to the Offenbach opera, the opera comique. Suddenly, this 30-year-old Bizet turns up and writes an opera that not only is about women of dubious character, but murderers and drug smugglers, but also writes this sort of early Verismo-type music where, you know, the overture of Carmen starts like it's an Offenbach overture, and then suddenly you get that, you know, those tremolo strings and that sort of fate motif, which sounds like Otello. I mean, how confusing must have that been for the audience, and how do we recreate that frisson instead of people just going, oh, God, not Mozart again. I mean, not Carmen again, sorry.
Well, we've run out of time, but I have to say that your Pelias from last year, it was a very strong season at Santa Fe, but that's the show that really stuck with me. And I didn't expect it to. I mean, I've always liked Pelias on paper, but I find it hard to sit through. But Hugh and Samantha and Zachary, they destroyed me. I mean, I was...
I honestly said to Robert when he wanted to plan it, I said, you know, every conductor wants to conduct it, every orchestra wants to play it, every director wants to direct it, every singer wants to sing it. The only trouble is nobody in the audience wants to be there. But I mean, I was really gratified because I think it was a musically, and I mean, just that it's a totally, totally profound piece. And I understand that it's not conventional opera, but it's for me, it's an absolutely seminal, genius piece.
Thanks to Santa Fe Opera for coordinating that interview. God, boy, Oliver really can't stop talking about that Pelias production. So, like, what do you think, Ashley? Was it actually the opera or just his crush on Hugh Montague Rendell?
You know, George, I do believe it is a little of column A and a little of column B. Our Oliver contains multitudes, but some of those multitudes are, when you've known him as long as we have, a little predictable.
A little of column A, and I would say a lot of column B. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast, Spotify, you're going to click follow, Apple Podcasts, hit that plus sign.
Chalk Talk on Opera Box Score.
We just had a fun series on the quality of voice departments, but what are those departments actually teaching, and how does it relate to what a modern freelance performer actually needs to know? So this came to my brain. There's been a lot of very, you know, jarring social media posts over the last 5 to 7 days that have really gotten people talking. Soprano Helena Dix, who is an active singer, put together a pretty insightful post about things that she thought it was really important for singers to know, but that they never, ever talk about. Things like, I don't know, how to do your taxes. So when we think about what it is that these music schools, especially the ones that we just spend a lot of time lauding and that we often laud in this industry, what are they teaching performers that are actual life skills? And the answer of that is not a lot. You know, nothing about taxes, very little about how you manage your living expenses when you're paid only for performances and not for rehearsals. You know, all these programs are teaching you how to beautifully interpret French opera, but not how to exist as a gosh darn human as you are trying to find places that people will pay you to do that French interpretation. And there are, to their credit, musicians who have figured out how to do this without any sort of instruction or guidance. And like, congratulations to those people. Why, however, are these life skills that people aren't being taught in these job training programs, why are those a silent gatekeeper? So not only do you have to be good enough to win an audition, but if for some reason you can't figure out all of these life skills with absolutely no guidance, you're toast, no career for you.
So Ashley, this segment is going to be you complaining.
I mean, kind of. You know, here's the thing. I could bitch about this for a minimum of 4 shows completely by myself. George wouldn't even need to be here for this. But I prefer to have solutions-based conversations. So mayhaps we can sort of drive some of those things and get people thinking and talking about this stuff more than they have in the last couple of days. So what realistically should a curriculum be for a modern singer in training? What are the things that should be added? Because there's only so many credits in a degree. You know, right. George, you and I are both higher education professionals. Yeah. We understand curriculum. So what would we need to sacrifice or amend so that we have room for these classes around the quote unquote business of singing? I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot, George. Mm-hmm. I know, you know, you and I are both higher education professionals. We've both worked for a number of music schools. We both understand different corners and different pockets of this business. But ultimately, we sit and we work with artists who are in training, and we're only training them for about, I don't know, 47% of what the actual job is going to be. So I have a few ideas, but I want to pause here and get some of your opening thoughts on this very, what I think will be interesting conversation.
Definitely. Well, here we are. We're music deans, co-deans of the Opera Box Score School of
Music.
And, you know, so some of these classes that we're going to discuss, they are offered, but they're typically like a master class, or it's that last day of the semester when you're kind of, you've run out of things to talk about maybe, or there's a sort of, oh, well, you should go to Wix and make a website. And then everybody moves on. So, yeah, how do we you know, get specific, and what has to leave the schedule? And I say this as someone who's like gainfully employed in teaching, but please, can we get rid of the like interminable opera scenes programs? Which I do question the value of that, because I think it's more helpful for students to prepare a single role from start to finish, even if that's from an opera that is written to be 5 minutes long or 10 minutes long. Many people I've talked to do not like this idea, don't disagree, and they think there's a lot of merit in being able to sing like one ensemble or one aria from this, that, or the other. But could we find a way to give our students that experience of creating something from start to finish? Fewer opera scenes programs to make space for some of the courses that you're talking about.
Yeah, I take your point, and I agree with it largely, but I also think it's important to sort of come at it with the idea of these curriculums were built for a reason. And so the idea of this opera scenes now, it's like this sort of thing that we sort of drag along into our curriculums, like we have to do these, you know, these credits and these scenes programs.
Right.
I think where that comes from, my guess, and at least I know this is part of the understanding from at least where my undergraduate program was, is that we didn't necessarily have the budget or the staffing or even sometimes the singers to do an entire opera. And so the scenes were a way for us to get some experience getting it sort of on its feet, because there's a difference in singing through a role start to finish in a studio and singing on a stage in front of people, even if those people are your peers, even if those people are your great aunt Linda who came into town for your scenes program, whatever it is. I do think you're onto something, though, about sacrificing these opera scenes. There has to be a better way for us to get that sort of stage experience and training into them. What that is, I'm not totally sure.
You want to program pieces which are complete works, but that are written to be like 5 or 10 minutes long. Every music publisher in the business has a whole roster of shows. You can search them. You can sort by length. I guarantee you there is a wealth of operas out there that are less than 15 minutes long. So essentially the length of any Mozart ensemble. And that you would then provide students with the ability to prepare those roles. Hopefully it would, you know, cut a course or two out of the curriculum so that into that could be slotted some of the more nuts and bolts of what it requires to actually do this job called being in the performing arts.
Yeah, kind of like a one-X festival in the way that they do it for theater majors.
There
you
go.
It's a way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Beautifully.
Yes. Yeah. So we just need operatic one-X. We need more of them, even though there are plenty. Get with your composition faculty. Get some one-X together. So yes, from a brass tacks angle, you know, sort of jumping off the points that Helena Dix made in her social post, I think about this a lot. Not just from, you know, a personal experience as a musician in training and then working in the industry that was training those musicians. But I think about this a lot from like a real basic standpoint. You know, if you're going to be an accountant, there are a series of courses that literally teach you how to be an accountant. Everything from the actual crunching of the numbers to this is how you manage a business. This is how you read a contract. And we just don't have the reciprocal on the performing arts side. I'm going to focus specifically on sort of what I think singers need to really have in terms of life skills to get into the opera world. But I think this is true for orchestral musicians. I certainly think it's true for jazz musicians. I think these things are really, really crucial. And so were I music dean tomorrow, I would immediately implement the following coursework or go yell at the State Board of Education until they let me implement the following coursework, because we know that's also part of the procedure. The first one is performing artist tax structure, federal, state, and global. Taxes are different at the state level than they're different at the federal level. If you've got singers that are going to be working overseas, there's a whole different tax structure there. Yeah. And I think for us to spend, what's a typical semester? 16 weeks? Spend 16 weeks unpacking that in a one credit class. We've got so many half credit, one credit classes in performing arts curriculums anyway. We can sacrifice a credit for performing arts tax structure. Another class I would have is contract law and regulation. How do you read a contract? Answer, most people don't know until they have to read one, and then they may miss something. I think a lot of undue harm to artists would be prevented if we gave them a solidified time and credit and a dedicated period for them to really understand what contracts look like, what they should be read in, even if they're written in your native language. Many of them aren't going to be, depending on where you work, but giving people that understanding of what a contract looks like so that they can walk into this with an ownership, with an agency, with a confidence. Agency meaning within themselves, not with an actual person.
I mean, even if they're written in English, right, and that is your native language, like, they are still incredibly confusing, and that's by design, right? Like, presumably a contract it's written in order to make it difficult for you, the signer, to actually know what you're signing away, right? It feels like it's just all one sort of trick.
It sounds to me like my buddy George has maybe had some trouble with contracts in his past, because he's pretty sure everybody's out to get him. No, I mean, if we're coming into this with good intentions, I don't think contracts are written to sort of pull a fast one on you. However, I think that not enough of us are, you know, versed in sort of how contracts are written. Now, if someone is trying to pull a fast one on you, a contract's an easy way to do it, because you can shove a whole bunch of legalese under what looks like a normal English paragraph, and then you're thrown for a loop. And of course, with performing artists, they're so excited to get the job. The idea that they would ever give any sort of pushback on something that's in a contract, until you're at that level of employment, that echelon where you don't feel like you have to take everything that comes your way, when there's no longer a scarcity mindset within you, you're not going to push back on that. Which leads me to another class that I would have in this magical musical curriculum is negotiation skills and strategies. Mm. Everything in life is a negotiation. Most of us don't really know how to do those things healthily and effectively. Some people do, and congratulations to them once again. But being able to have an insightful, intelligent conversation on sort of position versus intent and what it is that you are looking to get out of a conversation versus what you can offer to the conversation. This is something that's so key, and it's a life skill, and not enough people have it, and our world would be better if they did. What are your experiences with negotiations? Do you have those skills or those strategies?
You know, the book I go back to again and again on negotiation came out of Harvard, I think in the 80s, and it's called Getting to Yes.
Yeah, great book.
There you go, Ashley. That is the book I go back to again and again about how do you both parties, how do you continue to get to yes?
Yeah, it's not to go on too much of a tangent, but too late. So with negotiation, there's sort of two things to think about: position versus intent. Position is the thing that you're trying to get. So like, I want George to be at my house at 7 p.m. for dinner. My intent is I've been cooking all day. I'm excited to see my friend, and I'm really ready for us to hang out. So that's why I want him here at 7 p.m. The more you understand about my intent, the more you can warm to my position. That's not a super hard bargain. But at the same time, you see where I'm going with this. If we understand the why behind what someone wants, we're more willing to go into this with sort of a thoughtful, intelligent series of negotiations. So that's something that I think the world just needs more of on, like, I don't know, a lot of levels. But there are also a lot of other things that I think are really important for these curriculums. I'm going to rattle them off really quickly because I could go on about this, listener, for literal hours, and we don't have that kind of time tonight. Employment law for artists. I think, you know, this would just be an employment law class, but definitely the more you know about what is and is not legal in terms of American law, in terms of international law, although there's not a ton written for artist law at the international level. Introduction to nonprofit management. Okay, this is where we start to go into the areas where it's not just about being a freelance contracted musician for the biggest houses in the world. This is about what you're going to be doing when you're not singing for Vienna State Opera. This is where you understand the nuts and bolts of how nonprofits are run. It's going to help both with the nonprofits that you're working with. Also, you might get super creative and decide to start a nonprofit of your own. I've done that. I often recommend against it, but if it's something you're real excited about, it's something you should really know the ins and outs of, and it's a class I wish I would have had before I started my own. Principles of modern philanthropy and fundraising. Everything that we do is based on nonprofits that raise funds. Ticket sales are not the only way that these businesses come together. Philanthropy is a very long-standing tradition in the arts. Patronage used to look very different. We need to talk about the principles of modern philanthropy. How today are these organizations balancing their books? We report on this sort of stuff a lot, but if more people, especially the people working in these organizations, understood the how and the why, the more informed and the more impactful they would be in these organizations that they go to. And finally, introduction to pedagogy.
Yeah, geez.
People, whether you like it or not, there's going to be a time when you're an educator, whether it's in a contract in exchange for money or in a time where this is a teaching moment and you're going to have to learn how to get something across to somebody. We often have this cultural understanding, in at least we used to, in the music world of teaching is what you do when you can't perform. And that's simply not the case. You're seeing some of the greatest singers in the world accept these positions in universities. Why? Because they care about it, but also because they're not going to be performing forever. And it's good for them to understand that there are other opportunities and other jobs out there. And I love when there are singers who are active, Russell Thomas, you know, people, Amanda Majeski. I love when there are people who are active, big deal singers who are actually working and teaching. It's just something that I think we need to really all understand, that there may be an opportunity where you are asked to teach, and it's something that you're going to need to learn how to do, or at least know the very, very basics of. Your thoughts.
Exactly. Well, I mean, you know, players become coaches all the time in pro sports, and it's exactly the same thing, right? Like, singing is one part musicianship, one part acting, and one part athleticism, right? The body breaks down eventually. You know, you play in the NFL and then you can move into coaching. It's the same thing. Like, you're singing. Eventually, the voice just cannot sustain it. So obviously, you're going to go into teaching. For me, complaints about scenes programs aside, I enjoy teaching, and it motivates me because I think I have the possibility of continuing to transform this art form that I know and love from the inside out. And I can get to students and get them to be thinking differently about how we want opera to look in the coming years, and that they can go out and try and do those same things.
Agreed. I think that we're at a real turning point in the worlds and the fields of classical music. Higher education is often behind the times when it comes to sort of training in modern and innovative areas. I definitely have the privilege of working for an organization now that is sort of forward thinking when it comes to sort of how we do higher education. And classical music adds like an additional like 7 pumps of the brakes in terms of being able to innovate and amend these curriculums. But if we look at sort of how classical music training has evolved, it hasn't much in the last 25, 30, 40 years. A lot of the instruction that I was receiving, again, now a lot of the subject material that you're covering is certainly from, sometimes centuries ago, but the way that these pieces are brought into the now, we have to understand the business of making them go, because what we all want is for this art form to continue, but it has to be able to in a more modern business model, in a more modern format. And so we're going to have to find ways to make more people able to function in this world and in this industry on their own with more of an agency and a confidence in the business side of what they're doing. Because again, a lot of my teachers, for example, in graduate school, they were teaching me with the understanding and the mindset that the industry was going to be the way it was when they were there in the 60s and in the 70s. That model was already gone by the time that I was studying as a performer in the late 90s and in the 2000s. And it hadn't occurred to me to be like, yes, but how do I do this part? But how do I do this? They never had to do that. It didn't occur to them to be like, oh, this is how you do your taxes. They just magically started making money well enough that someone was doing their taxes for them. Well, not everybody's going to have that set of circumstances.
Definitely not.
Especially now. So I think it's really imperative that we think as a community in this art form that we love, and with these, institutions that offer this incredible training, there is a way, there's room for everybody and every class in the right kind of curriculum. And my hope is that in the coming weeks, months, years, decades, music schools really start to open their eyes to how they need to train people to be in these future industries.
I mean, you look at this list of classes that you've mentioned, and the fact of the matter is that on paper, they're not sexy, right? They're not attractive.
No.
These are nuts and bolts classes. And more than ever, they are so critical to survival in the business of the performing arts and trying to broaden that portfolio, right? As the years go by, we are seeing singers with bigger credits, bigger voices, more money, more powerful agents, all taking smaller and smaller jobs, right? And so that takes up space for that next level of singer down that previously had relied on that, right? So broadening the portfolio, taking care of yourself, and knowing all these ins and outs is just, it seems critical to trying to stay afloat as a performing artist.
Yeah. And, we can talk about the saturation of the market all day long and how there was this huge expanse and boom of voice programs in, insert random state university here. Is there a market saturation? Yes, possibly, especially when it comes to sopranos. No offense, ladies, but there's way too many of us. And the men that are sopranos as well. I didn't mean to. And the non-binary folks. I don't mean to exclude anybody. But that said, it's not like we train, going back to the accountants, it's not like we train accountants for one specific star job. It's not like there's one star accountant and then everybody else is kind of SOL when it comes to their training.
Right.
Why should the music industry be like that?
Yeah.
Why should it be like that?
It doesn't have to be. What you have to do is you have to learn these skills and then you have to practice them, right, in a safe place. And of course, that is what the college university experience is all about, right, is learning skills, getting some reps on them before you go out there where that safety net is a little more see-through or non-existent. Let us know what you're thinking about this. Mailbag at operaboxscore.com. You can even just leave us a voice memo on the website. operaboxscore.com. We want to know what you're thinking about how the curriculum for the vocal programs that we've been praising in our bracket over the last 3 weeks, what sort of changes they should be making.
Opera class. Sports radio crass.
This is Opera Box Score.
Jonathan Tettelman is having a breakout year. This Saturday, the Chilean-American tenor makes his Saturday Met radio broadcast debut as Ruggiero in La Rondine, which will also be broadcast in cinemas in HD. Next month, he continues his debut season as Pinkerton, which will also be a radio broadcast and an HD broadcast. So clearly, Peter Gelb wants us to notice this new artist, but he's not the only one. Tettelman recently released his second album on Deutsche Grammophon, The Great Puccini. With permission from the label, let's listen to an aria from Manon Lescaut, tenor Jonathan Tettelman with the Prague Philharmonia, conducted by Carlo Rizzi.
You know, when I first heard about you, I was like, oh, who's this guy? Like, what is Deutsche Grammophon trying to do here? You know, we've seen this happen before where it's like, oh, they found somebody who's good looking and they're going to give him a record contract and let's see what happens, you know. But mm-hmm. you're delivering, and this album, both of the albums are really good. And I don't know, it feels like you really understand the Italian style. And I wonder if you have, worked with somebody specifically who said, no, that's not Italianate. No, that vowel is wrong. No, I don't hear the internal consonant. Like, what is some of the stuff that really got you to get that flavor, that those very specific details? Or did you just grow up just knowing that that's how you sing it?
No, I've definitely had a learning curve. When I got to Europe, my Italian from my debut, I would say my Italian wasn't great. It was very American style Italian, or I should say American non-style Italian. It wasn't a specific person, but it was really a lot of experience. You know, I did my first performance of my first Italian performance in Torino. And I was working with Italian singers, and I was working with an Italian prompter and an Italian orchestra. And, you know, I really noticed that I was so far behind in my pronunciation that it was putting me even further behind in my style. And I asked the prompter to, he was very nice to do this. I asked the prompter to read the entire opera for me, everybody's lines basically that I was interfacing with. And I'd listen every day to his voice reading the Italian, and I would just copy it. And then that really got me on the right track, hearing the right vowels, sensing them, and delivering them. But it wasn't something that it was overnight. You know, I think it really takes a lot of experience to find this Italianate sound, because it's not for us in America. We talk very far down into our throats, and everything is really far back. And in Italy, they speak very with the larynx very neutral, very high, and everything is really directed out. So it's a completely different way of speech, and I think that's what one of the biggest challenges is. Being an American singer, is our language is really the complete opposite of how the Italians speak. And if you don't have the speech right, you'll never get the style right.
When we hear of Americans having success abroad, it's usually in Germany, but somehow you broke through in Italy. Did you feel that there weren't a lot of Americans around you, or did you feel like, ugh, this is a new experience for both of us, for both the house or the conductor and you at the same time?
You know, I think I'm just kind of like just making my way into Italy. I would say that actually most of my success is still in Germany. And, you know, I think that it's important for Americans to go to Germany first, because it's really actually it's a good experience to kind of just get used to the European style. And working with European people and European conductors and European orchestra, they play very differently than American, and the audiences are very different than in America. So I would say that, you know, Italy, I've kind of, you know, I've touched it, but there's much, much more that I would like to do in Italy. I just, you know, it's difficult, I think, for Americans there, because they don't accept the Americans so easily, you know, because it's their art form. You're going to their, you're going to their home field, and it's tough.
And I understand that contracting is not as business-like in Italy as it is maybe in a German house.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes if you have a good contract, that's a wonderful thing. But hopefully, you get paid on time or paid at all in some places. But I feel like, and I'm not the only American to feel this way, I feel like Italians, you know, especially the audience sometimes, and some of the, maybe the orchestra members and the people that work at the opera house, you know, they feel like, oh, this is an Italian theater. You know, these Americans, they should be paying us to sing here.
Okay, I have time to ask you one more question. I understand that you are originally Chilean. You're Chilean-American now. When we think about Latin American tenors, there are many that I can draw comparisons to for you, but is there a comparison that you don't appreciate? I have a name that I'm thinking of right now, and who started off sort of in the same Fach as you, and then maybe the voice got too dark for its own good. And the only reason why I'm bringing this up, because I want your voice to stay as lyrical as you can keep it for as long as you can, because it's really gorgeous right now.
Are you speaking of Ramon Binay?
No, I was thinking of Jose Cura.
Oh, Jose Cura. Okay. Well, actually, I'm glad, because I think Ramon Binay is probably one of the greatest opera singers. He's not a tenor. He's not a baritone. He's not a bass. He's an opera singer.
Yeah.
I mean, he's unbelievable force of nature. I mean, that man is one of my greatest heroes. But you know, I actually, it's interesting you bring up Jose Cura, and I love his singing. And I think him as an actor is also
incredible.
So captivating, incredible, good looking guy, great actor, great voice. But you know, I'm actually not tempted by dark. I'm actually tempted more by bright. I actually want my voice to reflect as much as possible. I'm always looking for maximum resonance. I'm looking for overtone partials up into the sevens and eights, and you know, you can't find that in dark. It doesn't exist. And if anything, I want my voice to get brighter, because I think that will express more the richness of my natural voice.
Okay, you said it. I'm going to hold your feet to the fire on that one.
You should.
Jonathan Tettleman, it's been great to meet you. I'm looking forward to watching you in HD, and definitely when you come to Chicago. Thanks for being on Opera Box Score.
A pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh.
from Jonathan Telemann's first album, Arias. A little bit of the aria from Flotov's Marta with the Orchestra Filharmonica de Gran Canaria, led by Carl Mark Chicon. Thanks to Crossover Media for putting us in touch. Jonathan Telemann in cinemas this Saturday in La Rondine.
This just in, the 2-minute drill.
All right, listen up. Here's everything you need to know about what happened in Operaland this week.
Classical music media, and all media for that matter, is ablaze this week. Following an article in New York Magazine, the article covers sexual assault allegations, denied tenure, and the firing then rehiring of two male members of the New York Philharmonic in the 2010s. Also covers the denial of tenure to utility horn Kara Kaiser and the dismissal of horn Amanda Stewart. We will unpack more after the drill.
Having just moved to the London Symphony Orchestra from the Royal Opera House, conductor Antonio Pappano told The Guardian that, quote, many people in the UK are embarrassed by opera. He went on to say, quote, you have to take care of the big places. There is a strange and misguided wokeism. If you're supporting an opera in a church basement or something, if that's more important than the Royal Opera House, give me a break.
Them's fighting words, Tony. Chechnyan authorities have announced a ban on music that falls outside a tempo range of 80 to 116 beats per minute. The new rule is intended to boost traditional Chechen mentality and musical rhythm and push back against the encroachment of Western-style pop music.
And presumably push back against patter songs. It's major award time. Australian opera director Barry Koski will receive Germany's Federal Cross of Merit in recognition for his tenure at the Komische Oper Berlin. Meanwhile, in Britain, the Olivier Award for Best New Opera Production went to Royal Opera House's production of Innocence, Kaija Saariaho's final opera. And the award for achievement in opera went to, hey, Antonio Pappano for his role as music director at Covent Garden.
Which is, as we've learned, not a church basement. Rolando Villazón was revealed to be the titular mass singer on the German version of the program. The tenor sang Queen's Somebody to Love, which Villazón called his favorite karaoke night song. The judges were unable to guess his identity until the big reveal.
Well, that doesn't bode well for the judges' inclusion as guests on the OBS. Deutsche Oper Berlin has announced their 24-25 season. We'll break it down after the drill.
Crunching the numbers. French Ministry of Culture has announced a reduction of 6 million euros from the Paris Opera's budget. The cut is one of several to state-funded arts institutions, such as the Comédie Française, National Theatre of Chaillot, and the Louvre. The announcement comes mere months after the opera company announced that they had generated a profit for the first time since 2017.
Didn't Molière found the Comédie Française? In trade news, famed Dutch conductor Ido De Waart has announced his retirement. De Waart has held music directorships at a number of major symphony orchestras, as well as the San Francisco Opera, and has conducted at major opera companies all over the world.
Exit stage right. German baritone Günther Leib has died at 96. German baritone Gerd Feldhoff passed away at 92. English baritone Nicholas Falwell has died at age 70, as has English mezzo Kerr Powell. Finally, German conductor Michael Bolder has died at the age of 65.
And on this day, April 14th, in 1654, it's the first performance of the opera ballet Le Nozze di Pelco e Tetti by Cavalli in Paris. 1833, the premiere of Delibes' opera Lakmé in Paris. 1922, it's the first radio concert broadcast from an airplane. Duh. Soprano Jeanette Vreeland sings as she flies over New York City. 1977, the premiere of Leon Kirchner's opera Lily, based on Saul Bellow's novel Henderson the Rain King. That was also in New York. And in 1981, the world premiere of Carlisle Florid's Willie Stark in Houston.
Got a couple of birthdays on this day. 1892 was the birth of Russian baritone George Sanofsky. He created the role of Major Domo in Barber's Vanessa. 1900 brought us the birth of Italian bass and movie actor Salvatore Baccaloni. He created a number of things for Wolf Ferrari, Michetti, Pizzetti, Guarino, all the hits. 1928 brought us the birth of American tenor Lauren Driscoll, who also created a bunch of roles for Floyd and Henza, sang in the premiere of Traum de Li Chung and Montezuma. And finally, happy birthday today on 1956, American soprano Barbara Bonney.
And that is your 2-minute drill.
Had some talk of early music today. We thought we'd treat you to a little bit of Barbara Bonney doing some "He Shall Feed His Flock" from The Messiah, a lovely piece with Bonney and the Freiberger Baroque Orchestra.
A very up and down drill this week. This story about the New York Philharmonic coming out just a couple days ago on the vulture.com website. This is difficult stuff to talk about. This is important stuff to talk about. Ashley, is there a way to kind of synthesize this story a little bit so that we can discuss?
How much time you got? Okay, we're going to try to nutshell this. Shout out to New York Magazine and freelance investigative reporter Sammy Sussman for putting this together. You would think that a story like this would come out of the New York Times, but no, they were too busy publishing a very puffy piece praising the orchestra and its diversity. I digress. All right, so the nutshell is that in 2010, the New York Philharmonic had hired two horn players, some of the first female players to be hired there, and one of those was the utility horn player Kara Kaiser. They went on tour, the New York Phil, to Vail, Colorado, and there was an incident that happened after one of these concerts where Kara Kaiser was socializing with some of the male members of the orchestra. I will spare you the very unpleasant details, but she woke up the next morning having no memory of many things that happened the night before and a lot of discomfort. We're going to fast forward way through this. She and her husband realize that something is wrong. She gets investigated, and it turns out that there is evidence of specific assault. Some of the police work in this was good. Some of the police work was not good. But all signs that we have, at least that are reported by Sussman in this article, point to her having been assaulted. And it could only have happened from these specific members of the New York Phil. So an investigation is launched. It doesn't exactly go anywhere. And also, she's not exactly supported in her case by her employer, by her fellow employees. There is one employee that really does try to support her, happens to be another woman in the horn section. I will fast forward through a lot of this. Both of them get denied tenure. And they're told what I'm going to call real BS reasons for not being granted the tenure that they were, for all intents and purposes, lined up for. They went from being rock stars that won an audition to 2 months later not laying it down properly and not being great performers. And so that happened, and then a series of other things pop up about this one specific trumpet player in question. I don't want to give him any publicity, except, yes, I will. His name is Mucky. And so eventually the New York Phil sort of launches an investigation. There's a series of inquiries that come through Amanda Stewart, who is the person who was supporting Kara Kaiser and trying to keep his investigation going, was also eventually not granted tenure within the New York Phil. This investigation that comes in, it's enough for this player, Mucky, and another player by the last name of Wang to be removed from their positions. They file grievances. They get employment lawyers. Eventually, they get their jobs back. So they are dismissed from the ensemble for, you know, misconduct. And then through a series of really goofy things that happen in arbitration, they get their jobs back. So now, what woman is going to feel safe in this orchestra after knowing full? And the thing is, this was kind of this was an unkept secret. It's kind of something that everybody knew, but nobody talked about. And nobody was willing to really step up on behalf of Kara Kaiser and speak about this injustice that we know happened. And so this has been kind of swept under the rug for a while. Both of these women have since left the orchestra. They actually ended up in a relationship together, and now they live together in St. Louis.
Right.
But they are now, I mean, the title of this article was a hidden sexual assault scandal at the New York Philharmonic. Two musicians were fired for sexual misconduct. Why are they back with the orchestra? And I encourage each of you to give this a look because I think it's just a really important story that should have been told a very long time ago. I will mention that auditions for the assistant principal horn and the utility horn at the Phil, that's Kaiser's former job at the Phil. The position's been vacant for years. They just started holding auditions for it last month.
Yeah. The length of time that this is all taken to evolve, to be discussed, to be talked about, and you know, now this article is just coming out here, is just sort of unbelievable. And then, of course, Dudamel about to move to the New York Phil as well. We'll see how this continues to play out.
Yes. If you're interested in further reading or further commentary on this topic, there are two folks in the social media sphere when it comes to Facebook that have both, I mean, they've kind of said everything that I could have possibly wanted to rant or rail about when it comes to our recording. So the first one's going to be Sarah Kirkland Snyder, and the next one's going to be Catherine Needleman, who is an oboist who actually lost the job in the New York Phil to one of these gentlemen who was eventually accused of misconduct. So if you just put in the name Catherine Needleman, you'll find all sorts of posts, and the one that she did 13 hours ago is pretty concise, hits the nail on the head.
Also linked to that article on the website, operaboxscore.com. The Deutsche Oper has announced its 24-25 season. It's funny, the Deutsche Oper of the three big Berlin houses, Unter den Linden, Komische Oper, and Deutsche Oper. Deutsche Oper is kind of my favorite in a way, right? So it's...
How so?
It's in the former West Berlin. It's a little more well-heeled. It's a little more conservative, I suppose. It's all relative, by the way, right? Like, the Deutsche Oper does plenty of the wacky stuff that would be sort of insane to even try and produce here. And there's a lot of friends of the show appearing in the upcoming season. Jonathan Telemann, as we talked about as well, appearing in Werther. Enrique Mazzola conducting Macbeth. What? Clay Hilly in Tannhäuser, Tristan and Turandot, the three T's. Samuel Hasselhorn also in Tannhäuser, Anthony Clark Evans in a different Wagner opera, Flying Dutchman, and Arya Nussbaum Cohen in Written on Skin, the George Benjamin piece as well, getting another outing. It's great. I'm always impressed how much that opera has been done since its premiere. It's just sort of show you thought might just kind of like end up in the pile. And actually, it's been getting a lot of airtime. On the directing side, we said this about the Bavarian State Opera when their season was released a couple weeks ago. You look at these lists, and as an American, you just want to cry at the sheer volume of work. The number of world premieres, the number of shows that are in the repertoire that are coming back right now. Let's just see how many premieres. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 premieres.
Nice.
Including, we talked about Macbeth already. An opera by Respighi called La Fiamma, which I've never heard of.
Sure.
Directed by Christoph Loy, which is great. That's conducted by Carlo Rizzi as well. Tobias Kratzer, genius madman, is directing a new production of Strauss's Die Frau ohne Schatten, which again is basically never done. Donald Runicle's conducting that. A brand new work by British composer Rebecca Saunders called Lash, Acts of Love. They are doing Rise and Fall of the City of Mahogany, the Kurt Weill piece.
I have questions, but yeah.
I would like... I'm looking at the dates now. I'm actually going to be in Europe. Wow, that would be incredible to see that. And then we talked about Telemann in Werther as well. Then you've got their studio space called the Tischlerei, the table factory, because the theater is in this old factory that used to make furniture. And just revival after revival after revival with just some of Germany's absolute tip-top directors, some of Europe's tip-top directors. It's the kind of thing that just like, I just want to sort of just win the lottery and just go just be there forever. So, but I can't. So I'm going to give up. Instead, I'm going to think about beats per minute.
I mean, just when you thought a section of Russia couldn't align itself any further with the opening scenes of Footloose, we have this return to, you know, pop music bad, children dance, no thank you. I mean, I get it. I'm all for, like, you know, cultural pride, cultural installation. But this feels so ridiculous. But I'll be very interested to see if anything changes with the region of Chechnya when they ban, you know, the magic that is Jojo Siwa. Just kidding.
This feels like a very strange way to, repress the people. It's much easier to be Antonio Pappano and being like, storefront opera doesn't matter and you shouldn't bother, which is essentially what he's saying. Quote, if you're supporting an opera in a church basement or something, that, and you think it's implied, he says, and you think that's more important than the Royal Opera House, give me a break, end quote.
I can't. How do you think we get the people that perform in the big houses? They've got to get practice somewhere. They don't get practice starting in the big houses. You got to have the stuff in the church basement. Also, not every city has a big house. You know what? Every city has a church basement.
Exactly. Similarly, with a price point, it's about access. It's about trying to get people into this art form as audiences and to stick around and to accrue experience and to feel the sense of belonging. And I guarantee you, fewer people feel like they belong at Covent Garden than they do in some storefront theater in the East End.
It's always fun to be here. It's so fun.
Let's wrap this show up.
Good call, bad call. On Opera Box Score.
Cedarquist and Hardgrave on the show this week. It's been real. I you know, I love these other guys to death, but sometimes when it's just a two-person show, it's great. It doesn't matter which two people it is. We all have our own. I mean, you could make combination platters for months with this roster that we have. But it's just something about tonight is really super fun. Good call, bad call. We're going to wrap it up. Ashley Hardgrave.
It is a good vibe, George. That is one of my good calls, is that this is a fun little vibe. The other thing that I just learned about and I need everybody / all my listeners to know about is the Tales Orchestra. Okay, so Pedigree, yes, the pet food company. They have created this, what I think is a ridiculously gimmicky and wonderful and brilliant marketing campaign. So, you know, dogs wag their tails, and they are often used by pet owners to gauge their moods. Are they waving fast? Are they waving slow? Are they waving at all? What if a dog's tail wag was a musical baton? What if canines and their happy moods and their tails were the conductors? So Pedigree put the dog center stage with the Polish radio orchestra and filmed them. And so the orchestra is playing pieces, and each of the sections of the orchestra are going not by a conductor, but by the wagging tails of these dogs. And the dogs are presented with different stimuli. And so that makes their tails move fast or slow, depending on how happy they are. So kudos to Pedigree. Kudos to all the dogs, and kudos to the Polish radio orchestra for being amazing sports about this.
That's it for this week's edition of America's Talk Radio Show about opera. Make sure you subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Get your voice heard and find links to stuff we've talked about at our website, operaboxscore.com. Hey, that's also where you're going to put your money where our mouths are. Give back to the OBS using the Support the Team tab. Your announcer is Norm Waddell. Your creative consultant is Oliver Camacho. And your audio editor is Weston Williams. For Ashley Hardgrave with our guests Harry Bickett and Jonathan Tettelman, I'm George Cedarquist, asking you to continue the conversation about opera between your classes of Introduction to Nonprofit Management and Principles of Modern Philanthropy and Fundraising. We're back with an all-new show next week. Plus, you get more opera headlines, more hot takes, and more. Join us.